Our landscapes push aside wildlife and in turn diminish our genetically programmed love for wildness. How can we get ourselves back into balance through gardens to speak life's language and learn from other species? My guest today is Benjamin Vogt, who poses the questions and proposes answers in his new book, A New Garden Ethic, Cultivating Defiant Compassion for an Uncertain Future. Welcome to the show, Benjamin.
Thank you so much for having me on.
First, I have to ask, what do you mean by defiant compassion?
That's an excellent question, and certainly one others have asked. The defiant comes in the fact that we are in a period of mass extinction and climate change, and species are vanishing, and the world's weather is becoming more turbulent. And we live in a culture that works to deny those realities and to affect positive change. So you have to almost be defiant. And then the compassion comes in where, well, we need to start to take care of each other, and we need to take care of all the plants and the animals around us on the world if we're going to continue to survive and thrive on this planet. So that's the mix of defiance and compassion in the book.
I like that. Within the first couple of pages, you tell the story of the grasshopper and the spider, and it seems a metaphor for a new garden ethic. Can you explain that to our listeners?
Yeah, so I was feeding grasshoppers into a spider web, and at first I thought that was just so neat to see how the spider responded and how it, you know, injected the grasshopper. And then I thought, you know what, this is probably pretty gosh darn unethical. I'm literally killing one creature for the benefit of another without really understanding why. And I realized I was doing it just for my own pleasure. And I know it sounds kind of sick and twisted in a way, but I was privileging one species over the other, and that wasn't right.
Yeah, and it's hard for us to really kind of understand that when we don't have that closeness to wildlife, to the earth and the natural order of things either. I'm a gardener, and I love having my hands in the earth, and my thoughts on this have also evolved since getting into it. And in your book, you say in 2007 is when you and your wife started your garden. What was the catalyst that changed your thinking on gardens?
Well, I mean, I grew up with a mother who gardened, so I knew about gardening to a certain degree. But when I actually had the opportunity to have my own, there were a lot of hard lessons, and yes, certainly light bulbs that came on. But I was at the nursery, and I was picking plants that had the little butterfly symbols on them because I wanted to attract butterflies. And so I got some milkweed, brought it home. A couple weeks later, there were caterpillars over it, destroying the leaves. And halfway back from the garage, carrying my poisons, I realized, wait a second, what's going on here? I'm gonna Google this and see what these caterpillars are. And of course, they were monarchs. And of course, you know, then I started gardening for them, and then for other species. So,
and it's funny because I've noticed too that I get questions from people. Well, how do I get rid of this bug? Well, first let's identify what that is, and then let's think about whether it's necessary to do anything. And it's interesting, and I do feel like things are changing, but it's not fast enough really for what we've done to the earth. What are we doing to our own mental and physical health by living in the monocultures?
Yeah, I mean, we have monocultures of corn and soybeans, of course. We have monocultures of lawn, especially, you know, in suburban and urban areas. Lawn is the dominant feature. So, for example, when you have kids in a classroom looking out the window and all they see is lawn and concrete, that's not really benefiting or helping them. When kids look out of the classroom and see flowers and trees and shrubs and diverse view of nature and birds and butterflies flying around, their test scores improve. Their creativity goes up. They're able to work in groups better. They're less depressed. It treats ADHD. And same thing for hospital patients. Same thing for people working in an office building.
Diversity is good for everything.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, we are nature. It's in our blood. We know it, but we keep pushing it away, and it literally makes us unhealthy.
And why do we do that? Why do we push that away?
I think it might be asking you a very big question. Yes, you are. I think a lot of it has to do with culture, but even in maybe greater part is evolution. We evolved from grasslands in Africa and the ability to see danger coming from a distance. And I think that's why we like lawn. I like monocultures of lawn, and so we can see the danger approaching. Yeah. So I think it's something very deep in our genes.
And, you know, that sort of reminds me of birds that feed on the ground. When you're feeding them, you give them a space so they can see a predator coming, whereas the birds that eat from above, they need the shelter. So it's kind of interesting. We are talking with Benjamin Vogt. He is the author of A New Garden Ethic, Cultivating Defiant Compassion for an Uncertain Future. Why is it that it seems like maybe that does speak to the answer you just gave me in terms of why we sometimes want such a formal look to gardens?
Well, in another part is culture. Like I was saying, our American gardening culture specifically is passed down to us from English and French aristocracy, where you had huge swaths of lawn, and that showed your nobility and wealth, and that you had so much money you could just waste it by having people care for your lawn all the time. That's part of it.
And it seems sort of odd when you think about it, because really, how orderly all life actually is. I mean, how there are reasons for things, and there's a chain that happens, and sometimes we just don't see the forest for the trees, so to speak.
Oh yeah, I mean, A is connected to B is connected to C, and then everything is a fractal. Everything is actually a mathematical equation. So you can coastlines, sunflowers, forests, storms, everything can be mapped out with a mathematical equation. So it's incredibly ordered.
It's crazy.
It's cool.
It is. And you came to Minnesota as a 10-year-old. How did that shape your relationship with nature?
I think it radically reshaped myself. I spent the first 10 years of my life in Oklahoma, and while back then I did not appreciate it, in effect hated the flatness and the wind and the heat, I've come to appreciate it more the older I've become. But no, when I was 10 and moved to Minnesota, it was just night and day. There were so many trees, and there were birds flying everywhere, and there were lakes everywhere. You went to the lake, you know, there was winter. And that people went outside in the winter like it was still summer. They went skiing and walking, you know. So it was just, people were out in nature. There were parks everywhere. There was everything.
Yeah. Yeah, and we are very lucky here in the town of Northfield that we have so many wild spaces, and our city council has just made a strategic plan which includes awareness of climate change, and are working towards some things like that. But what I find amazing is that there are still people who insist that we are not responsible for at least part of climate change.
Sure.
And sort of like, how is that possible? But that's the way it is, I guess. How does evolution play in species? I mean, we evolved and plants have evolved, and how do we know how badly we've affected something, or perhaps we've affected it in a good way?
I don't think we can know. I mean, maybe if you're just studying one organism over the course of your lifetime, you might be able to figure out 50% of the answers to the questions you have. That's why I'm such a native plant proponent. You know, we don't know what we're doing, but why not trust in evolution and the fact that these plants know what they're doing, and that they've evolved very specific relationships with the wildlife around them, and they all know each other and they know how to use each other. Why do we want to bring in something plant from China when nothing can use it, and we don't know if it's going to become invasive or not?
Yeah, like buckthorn.
And things like so many things. Honeysuckle.
Oh yeah. I had a honeysuckle, and it was the wrong variety. It came in a container marked wrong.
Wrong.
Yeah, and I dug it out, And it took forever. And I looked at the roots and thought, are you kidding me? This thing is crazy. It was taken over. Again, we're speaking with Benjamin Vogt. He is the author of A New Garden Ethic. And as you talk about the native plants, now we also have a multi-billion dollar industry of humans that are creating new cultivars. How does that fit into our landscapes and our thoughts on native plants?
We certainly do have a tendency. I mean, it is an industry. It's a commercialization of what I consider sentient life, and I have ethical issues with that, even though I'm in the garden profession. Mm-hmm. Plants are not shoes. They're not new clothes. These are not purely decorative items. They carry incredible weight and importance in our landscape. So when we breed a plant that has a different flower color or a different leaf color, we are affecting that plant's ability to function and work well in the environment with things like pollinators. Mm-hmm. If you change the flower color of a flower, there's going to be chemical changes in the plant that could affect the nutrition of the pollen or the nectar or even the leaves for larvae that are eating it.
And what I've found interesting, too, is that when these cultivars come, there's something you lose. I mean, you pay for this. There's something that happens, you know, like even a rose bush, you know, where you've got this beautiful flowers. You're talking about chemicals. You've got this beautiful flower, but it doesn't smell. It doesn't have the fragrance or whatnot. But there's something you write in your book, and it's, I'm going to read this. There is no unspoiled nature. There is only us and a world we garden for the good of all of us, or for the good of just some of us. We either take the long view or the short view. We either privilege ourselves now at the expense of those who come after, or we privilege those who come after while reviving our current world. I like that. I thought that was pretty profound.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm glad you read that.
I did. I think the book is, I'm really enjoying a new garden ethic, and I would encourage folks to read it. Benjamin Vogt. And one last question is, what is the most important thing you want people to get from a new garden ethic?
I want people to get that we are not separated from all the other species around us, that we are all equal. We're created equal. We're in this together. And I want folks to go outside and listen to the birds, watch the wasps on a flower. Wasps are good. Watch the spiders. Just be out there and be alive again, because we deny our lives so much of the time.
Yeah. And I think with the way the world is turning right now, I've talked with some other people too, a gentleman that wrote Being the Change, and talked about how things really are changing and we're not going to have a choice in certain matters.
No, we're absolutely not going to have a choice. And that's unfortunate that we have to take that step and be at that point.
Right. Well, Benjamin, thank you so much for your time. What's next for you?
Next for me, I'm speaking all over the country constantly. I'm going to be in Chicago soon, and Tampa, and Seattle, and L.A. in the spring. So I think that's next.
That's good. Pushing the word out.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right. Thank you. Appreciate your time. A New Garden Ethic. It is by Benjamin Vogt. Thanks again.
Yep, you bet.